All this is very interesting. Do we see that one of the central points in all that you have said is just this? The name just conjures up images. We are unable to see the living being. Our own name conjures up kind of a picture on the wall. See, this is the important thing. In other words, we are not yet capable of being aware in the real sense. Awareness is a living thing in the immediate now, absolutely living now. You might say, but these names were, so many of them were of the past. But the past is living now. Where there is awareness, the past has no meaning as past, as a mere dead past. One can contact the living person that was, but we can't. Everything becomes a memory. Everything becomes an image. Life, in other words, we are not in touch with. In our inner awareness, in a vital, throbbing, real way. Put it in another form, psyche cannot meet psyche. Images, all the time images only. Conditioned reactions. Therefore, how can there be real relationship? How can there be love in the transcendent sense? How can one know another? And in that knowing, the gulf is bridged, which means that the living relationship is there. See, this is a very interesting way of discovering our flebileness. We are limp in this respect. We cannot form living relationships. Now contrast with this, the way one sort of handles a little pet and strokes it with affection and this, that and the other, or a child, a little child or something, you see. In that little process, there is a kind of a living interplay, an actual living interplay. All your feelings, your whole being goes out to that thing for that moment. There is no demand, hope, expectation or anything. There is a real interaction between this living thing and this living thing. But otherwise, apart from that, what living interplay do we have with any human being? The bus driver, the bus conductor, the postman, the wife, the husband, the child, everything is... It's as if we live in a world where so many puppets are moving about. And yet each one is a living being. Understand this, we understand in a very deep measure something of the nature of loneliness. We live isolated. See, we live isolated. And this living isolated is a sort of a living unredeemed. Unredeemed. You may remember at the party, I just said a few words about Christmas representing the birth of the Christ consciousness. Now, Christ is presented in Orthodox Christian terms as the Redeemer. He gave his life as a ransom for the many. How does redemption take place in the ordinary material way in our life? I leave my watch at the pawnbroker's and he gives me £15 for it or whatever it is. you see, which is one-tenth of its actual price. But a few days later, I gave him back the £15, and I have redeemed. That is redeeming. You look it up in the dictionary, you'll find that that is the sort of explanation given. You see, that is redeeming the object. Redemption. Now, that is in the material sphere. There is an exchange, an impersonal, inanimate exchange between two people, and redemption takes place. But what does redemption mean in the case of Christ the Redeemer? This Christ consciousness, which is the Redeemer. What is the ransom which I pay for being redeemed? Here we can look at what Jesus said when he asked for the penny, unto Caesar what is Caesar's. But Caesar takes all that belongs to Caesar. But the all that belongs to Caesar is only a fraction, maybe a large fraction, maybe a tenth, maybe two-thirds, three-quarters of what I have in material possession. All right, unto Caesar that, but unto God, I have to give what is God's. And that is the totality of my being. But the totality of my being doesn't stop here. You see, the totality of my being is the totality of the universe. Am I cut away from the universe? I'm completely, in actual fact, without my knowing it, wholly and completely related to the whole world, all the time. And unto God, it's the totality every time, through each individual being. So that is the redemption, if you like, which means that we grow in awareness in such a manner that there is no break in awareness of the transcendent in the individual being. This is redemption. This is the meaning, surely, of the birth and the fruition of the Christ consciousness as such. But is this not the same as the bodhicitta of the Buddhist? The bodhicitta is just precisely this. It puts one in, as it comes to fruition, there is the complete state of communion, the perfect communion, the knowing communion, and all our tribulation and sorrow and so forth, all our dukkha, our pain, suffering, misery, evolution, development, is the process, the becoming process through which the unknowing communion with which one started has become the perfect communion in its ultimateness. Now, as and when that happens, the name, when pronounced, drops away like that, together with all the images that it would have conjured up. And living being is in communion, in everlasting union with living being. My God, we'll have a different world then, as and when that can happen. But you see, an experiment like this shows that it cannot happen even with one person. Even self-love, whatever that may be, is not strong enough to produce it for our own selves. Consider then the enormous significance of the Buddha statement, he who lives without harming himself, without harming others, lives with a self become Brahman, the ultimate reality, the supreme. Man's divine destiny, if you like to look at it that way, as something to achieve, something worthwhile having, if we want to look at it that way. Now, one may ask, well, how does this fruition. How can it emerge? In order to understand how it emerges, let us look at the direct answers that all the great teachers gave to the problem of human suffering, misery, the problem of human loneliness, loneliness in the sense in which we have just looked at it, that we are cut off. We are just images. We are only conscious of ourselves as images and of everyone else and everything else as images. And this conditioned mind continuously interferes, therefore, with the moment-to-moment living experience. All right. What was the answer? What was the direct answer? Jesus said, the kingdom of heaven. Muhammad said, paradise. And so forth. The Buddha said, nirvana. His direct answer to the whole problem of humanity and of the individual is not a welfare state. It is not a method by which I shall be healthy and well and strong, by which all my wonderful potentialities shall be drawn out, you know, one for all and all for one and equal opportunities for everybody and so forth, you see. Nothing of that sort. No political, economic plan or system or anything at all. The answer is totally unworldly. And it's the answer to the worldly situation. The answer is to the separate individual, unrelated to the whole, to each and every separate individual. But the answer is the whole. If somebody asked God, what hast thou to give unto man? God says, myself. And myself is the totality, the absolute totality, the transcendental totality. Isn't it extraordinary? That the answer is given in terms of the transcendent, not in terms of the worldly. It is not the solution to a problem. It is not a panacea for all sorts of difficult situations. It is a transcendent answer which has no meaning, no content, no shape, nothing which you can make an image of in worldly terms. Needs stout hearts and strong minds to deal with this sort of strong meat. Can we see its significance? Surely one of its deep significances is that we are not awakened. We are aware, we are conscious of our life only like dreamers. Phantasmal shapes pass by, images all the time. They are all images, not the living reality. How do we spring out of this dreamy condition, this confused dreamy condition? And the key here, obviously, is mindfulness, attentiveness, which is the way I attend. Look back at the way I attend to various circumstances or conditions. The way I attend to this, that, or the other person. I'm only calculating as I look at him or her. Calculating for the fulfillment of my desire. I may say, oh, but I'm quite concerned with him or his benefit and this, that, and the other only. Am I? It would seem so. I'm concerned for his benefit. I'm concerned with saving him trouble, misery, and so forth. But, according to my preconceptions and my desire relative to him, the whether my desire is good or bad or right or improper or whatever is not at issue at all. We'll grant the complete sincerity of the situation, but we must see the fact of the situation. I attend to a person in terms of my desire. I'm always calculating. This fellow will be useful in this, that and the other way. Always there is this calculation. And my behavior is in those terms. I'm never completely open, altogether transparent to the other person. Only if I can wholly give myself, which means that my personal self-consciousness as a separate being is clean out, then all's well. Then there is no conflict possible. It takes two to make a quarrel. But if I am out of it as one quarreler, there can be no quarrel. Take any situation, every situation from hour to hour each day, I look at with a calculating mind. I attend desirously, as I said the other day. I attend desirously. And I don't know that I'm attending desirously. I'm caught in the net. Therefore there is dukkha always. The far from the transcendent. The spoilt infinity, which means the constricted particularity, the conditioned state, the imprisoned state. But if I am fully aware, if I really attend to this and watch out for all the elements that constitute my attention, my attentiveness, just watch out for them. Look at them, they will gradually change of their own accord. Because all these elements are energy, psychical energy. You don't destroy it, you don't throw away your bank balance. It is power. Now, when there is this type of attentiveness, it is a case of the being in complete awareness who is attending thus. And this attentiveness releases action, releases that transcendent power which acts. The Christian puts it in these terms, the grace of God functions. I am the obstructor to the grace of God. But when I cease to be the obstructor, by this kind of attentiveness, this complete mindfulness, then the grace of God functions freely. And then whatsoever action follows is essentially right action, perfect action. Otherwise, it's my activity, with my desire, my calculatingness behind it, which spoils it. It is as if we all had to become divine scientists, divine technicians. Psychological technicians. So then, under such circumstances, under such conditions, the redemption is there. There is no self to interfere. Let us look back to this answer which the great teachers give. It's always in terms of the transcendent. It's a very important point. If we look at the way in which the Buddhist texts present it, and they present present the whole situation and what happens, so to say, in far greater detail than any of the others do. You see? What do we find? The Buddha says that seeing birth, the conditioned state, jati, seeing aging, becoming decrepit, breaking up, seeing the passing away, seeing this imprisoned condition in the endless round which just goes on again and again through the mind, he sought liberation, which is called nirvana, Well, what does he say about it? Seeking the unborn. How does he describe nirvana? The unaging, the undying, the sorrowless. He says, I won that which is the unborn, the unaging, the undying, the sorrowless. Those are the words in which the thing has come down to us. I sometimes wonder whether the Buddha said precisely that, I won. Because there are considerable limitations to that type of expression. It is as if the existential being, the limited entity, obtained the infinite, which of course is impossible. Empirical entity, which is mortal, inevitably mortal, cannot possibly win and hold and enter infinity. It's the other way about. Existential being can only cease to be an obstruction to the immortal, to the infinite. It can cease to be an obstruction. One of the proofs of this is that when the Buddha retails all the different stages through the jhanas and the samapattis, the final stage, which is the real thing, is the stopping of all feeling and perception. That means I, the perceiver, I, the experiencer, am not there. Therefore, the infinite is unobstructed by this. That is the proof of it. If you really understand that, then we can easily see all the faulty expressions which are scattered through all the scriptures of the world. They all have some expressions which are quite faulty. If you take the classic a statement in the Upanishads, Aham Brahmasmi, I am Brahman. But if they had put it this way, Brahman is me, it's a very different situation altogether. The I normally stands for the limited entity. However, understanding that, we can go on. He wins the unborn, the unaging, the undying. Or what does that mean, obviously? Because he ages and he dies himself. It might have been much better to say that the unaging, the undying won him. But where he is concerned, it is his awareness which has become completely transformed. It's the transmuted awareness. Surely that is what it refers to. Now, if there is this transmuted awareness in the individual, does that mean that the problems of society are solved? It doesn't mean that at all. And it also means that all the problems of society are solved. Let us look at the first statement, that the problems of society are not solved. When we consider this, we consider the solution in terms of images again. This country has £2.10 per head per annum. Oh, ghastly poverty. We must get rid of that. It has to be £250, not £2.10 per annum. Then it's a little bit better per head. See? That is the solution. We have a form. This country has 25% of the children not going to school. No, they must all go to school. That is the solution. It is all in terms of forms. But if you realize the transcendent, are 25% that 25% of children immediately going to be in schools? No, they're not. What happens then? Being aware of the transcendent real, oneself has ceased to be a producer of evil. Completely cease to contribute all those forces which bring about a condition of suffering for oneself as well as others. That is one aspect of it. The other aspect, another aspect is that what one is constantly influencing, affecting everybody else. In a way against which he has no defenses. The barkeeper in the local pub has no knowledge of the transcendent or any such stuff. He sets up no barriers against whatever influence may go out from my awareness to him. It changes him without his knowing it. Like the sun shining. The sun just shines, and lo and behold, the soil and human beings and everything gets the benefit of it. Plants and whatnot, they get the benefit of it. So in that way, that is another way in which the answer to the problem material terms goes on by itself. And of course, the man who is here, the ordinary man, says, but I want this result now. Ah. Plant an acorn. Will you say you want your oak tree now, tomorrow morning? Can't have it. Everything happens in the ripeness of time. Everything that happens is the resultant of the sum total of forces in operation. And in terms of manifestation, everything is limited by space and time. So we have to have patience for that. See, this is the irresistible influence of him who has realized. The world is today, is what it is today, here and now, because of all the forces that have played upon it. The Attilas and Julius Caesars and the Buddhas and Christs and the Shakespeares and Beethovens and the Tommy Tompkinses and everybody. The responsibility is an individual responsibility. But it behoves us who seek to understand these things, who seek to live seriously, religious-mindedly, it behoves us to appreciate the significance of the fact that the answer, the direct answer which all the great ones gave, was the transcendent answer and not the matter-of-fact answer as any ordinary person in the world would want. No matter-of-fact answer at all. Why does the transcendent answer, let me put it the other way, why don't we immediately wake up to the significance of that fact, of that transcendent answer given to us? This is a mirror which shows what we are. Just as the great teachers sometimes have said of themselves that they are the mirror in which we can look at ourselves. The fact that I cannot appreciate the significance and import and the instantaneous efficacy of that transcendent answer, why I cannot let the miracle happen, is because I am obstructing the miracle. When did Jesus' miracles come off? When the person had completely repented, turned away. To repent means to turn away from. When are we in the true state of repentance? When our attentiveness is perfect. When we see the false as the false, the evil as the evil, then we are ripe for the turning away. Otherwise there is something which holds us hard. You see? And we are bound. We are drawn back. Little bit like that giant Fafner, who saw the glint of Freya's eye, you see, through a chink in the heap of gold, and poor old Wotan had to chuck away the ring of power too in order to fill that chink. It's very, very significant. And then Fafner says, oh, lost her. Takes away the gold. And what happens immediately? The two fight, Fafner and Farsold, and Fafner is slain. But what happens to Farsolt afterwards? Farsolt is slain. What happens to Fafner afterwards, the one who stuck to power? He forswore love. Loved lust, that is, he forswore. And he obtained power. You see, slew his brother, Farsolt. And then, in his turn, he is slain by Siegfried. Inevitably. He can't use that power. He has a heart. Has the brute a heart? Asks Siegfried and thrusts his sword. His sword there. There, take that. Finished with it. So, in the same way, we too, we are not awake to the tremendous significance of the nature of the answer which the great teachers gave. They gave the perfect answer, the transcendent. Render unto God what is God's. You see? The answer to all dukkha is nirvana. It involves, then, perfect renunciation. The perfect letting go. The perfect non-grasping, the non-clinging to anything and everything, including nirvana. This is where the difficulty comes. Because this, with its 15 billion cells, is all crying out for the reverse. And it has a great power. This imprisons vision. Pure vision, pure God is locked up in this. And God is liberated out of this, not by destroying this, but by the complete understanding of this. Then the power inside this, which at present constricts, holds in the transcendent reality, becomes now, every one of those cells becomes the gateway, the open gateway for that transcendent reality. And the body itself is in fact the temple of the Lord then. See, one of the very significant things in the Tejabindu Upanishad, for instance, both statements are made within a few inches of each other in the text, you see. The body is the temple of the Lord. The Lord that dwells in is Shiva, the auspicious one, the happiness bringer. See? And a few sentences later, the body is impure. And there's a magnificent piling up of all the impurities of the body is given. So you see, to really to understand this, understand it in such a way that the fact which the words try to embody has actually become part and parcel of one's whole psyche. This is the important thing. Otherwise there is no liberating. Otherwise fresh images only are formed by the words. This is our difficulty. I mentioned renunciation now. So what do we give up? We give up all our images. We get rid of our idols, in other words. All our wonderful ideas, our beliefs, our conclusions and so on. What remains is pure attentiveness, really vital, alive. So that the creative renewal which takes place, instant to instant, we are aware of that. We are with it all the time, instead of clinging to any and every idea, however true or accurate it may be. It's true, it's accurate, yes. But so what? Being an image, being outside me, it's no food for me. My psyche wants to eat truth and digest it. It's no good. My psyche, my mind looking at truth in the distance, that doesn't solve my problem. I have to become the truth, eat it, digest it, then it, I assimilate it, don't I, afterwards. This is the whole point. So now, the next question, well, how do I eat the truth? And this is where Krishnamurti, of course, has made, out of several such contributions, one of the most extraordinary contributions to the whole art and science of living. Look at that which is not the truth. Look at that which is not harmony, as it takes place inside me, myself, now. You see? And in the complete looking, in the complete seeing, he uses the phrase, there's an explosion in the mind. I hesitate you acquiescing with that expression, because anybody hearing that might think you go crackers. You see, he's got an explosion in his mind. Yes, he sounds very much like it says the so-called matter-of-fact, commonsensical fellow of the world. But he doesn't know what on earth the reality is. But there is this transmutation. It's a real transmutation. You bombard the nucleus and lo and behold, another element has been formed. A new element has been created. Transmutation. It's a transmutation in the real sense. As that transmutation takes place, the renunciation is there. There is nothing to catch hold of and give away and say, I forgo this, I forgo that. All the time, lusting after God, after heaven, after nirvana, and so forth. Nothing of that sort happens. It is necessary in the in the beginning, always to hear, to listen to the word, or to read it, to see it. The written word or the spoken word is indispensable. It is there. But if that written or spoken word is attended to completely like that, free of desire, free of images within oneself, this is the difficulty. You have to look at the images as they arise to interfere. You see? Then there is this. The psyche eats the truth. This is the bread of life which the realized, the perfected Holy One can give. This is the meaning of the bread of life. He can give it. And there is another way in which he can give the bread of life. If the other is ready, then the mere proximity of the two produces this sort of sparking over, this kind of spiritual induction, as I call it again and again. A spiritual induction, and the other person's awareness is transformed. You know, you get this put in symbolic form in the Gita. Krishna says to Arjuna, Arjuna says, may I behold the divine form, you see. Krishna says, yes, certainly, but you can't see it as you are. I give you the divine eye with which to see the divine form. I give you the divine eye. You see, if someone is tremendously, if he is the liberated one, utterly aware himself, if the two sit quietly side by side, just quietly, not a word, the other person's awareness opens up. Now this is beautifully expressed in that story of Elijah, Elisha. Notice the names of the towns where they are supposed to go through. It's supposed to be a journey in physical space, in the land, you see, from town to town. But that is the childish way of looking at it. It's the symbolic way. Gilgal is the first place. Gilgal means the round, the circle. And we know what the round is. The round of dukkha, which constitutes the whole of birth, death, etc., etc., the grasping after pleasure, the enjoying of it, the fading away, the pain, again another grasping, the whole thing just goes round and round. This is Gilgal, out of the circle of misery and sorrow. Then they go to Bethel. Beth-El, the house of the Lord. El, El is the Lord. And El is the Lord in the aspect of the strong one, the powerful one, the divine power. They go into the house of the divine power. You see, I mentioned power, the released power of the Christ consciousness through right attentiveness, which brings about, releases the complete redemption, and so forth. All right, they go into the house of the Lord. You see, the house of the divine power. And, you know, each time the sons of the prophets, as they are called, tell Elisha, know you not that the Lord will be there, that your master will be taken away from you? And he says, shut up, I know all about that. You see, and so forth. And the next place they go to is Jericho, the place of fragrance. Jericho means fragrance. The perfume. You know how in the Mass we have this phrase, the sweet savor of a holy life. The fragrance, the sense of joy, the sense of beatitude which steals into one's being. And again, the sons of the prophets standing on the other bank always, you see. And again, Elisha gives the same reply. Then they go to Jordan. And one of the meanings of the name Jordan is the place where the waters divide, go separate ways. And that is the last place. And Elijah takes his mantle, and lo and behold, the waters move out and they cross over the dry spot. The dryness signifying stability, firmness, firm ground, you see. They won't be swept away with the waters. And the waters typify, amongst other things, inspiration. You can easily be carried away by your inspiration, and it can bring about confusion. You see? All right, and they go over. And then Elijah says, ask for a boon. And Elisha says, let a double portion of thy spirit be upon me. Thou hast asked a hard thing, says Elijah. The significance is this, that in the Jewish custom, the eldest son's share was twice as much as the others. The double portion be my inheritance, and the others all received in equal shares, or whatever it was, you see, and so forth. Thou hast asked a hard one. Nevertheless, if thou canst see me when I am taken away from you, so shall it be unto you. You see? If thou canst see me when I am taken away from you. And then there appears the famous chariot. You see? And Elisha says, O my father, the horsemen of Israel. And remember, Israel, the word Israel means ruling with God. Co-ruler with God. That's what the meaning of Israel is. The horsemen of Israel, you see. And Elijah is taken away from the chariot. But Elisha sees him as he is taken away from the chariot, in the chariot. And this being taken away in the chariot like that, you see, in this disappearance, where? Into the void. Is the stopping of feeling and perception, the supreme jhana or samapatti of Elijah, if you like to use the Buddhist terminology for it. And this one sees it. Obviously, he doesn't say things. There are no words which are spoken. But this is teacher and disciple making the journey together. Without anything said, the spiritual induction. And because Elisha was able to be with his teacher, succeeded in being with his teacher, step by step like that, the mantle of Elijah falls on Elisha. And Elisha is henceforth the teacher in Elijah's place. Elijah, Eliyah, God himself. Elisha is God the Savior. Redemption. Where are your meanings and significances? Now, how was Elisha able to be with Elijah like that? There was nothing of selfness to be held on to. So he was able to go through all the stages with Eliyah, the incarnate God, if you like. But the Jews never would have it that way. They wouldn't give that up. It takes someone outside the fold who is not under threat of excommunication or damnation or anything. He can say, yes, this is what it really means, whatever you may like to believe. But this is what it really means. And so Elisha is able to renounce completely all that would be commonly regarded as the image Elisha. And therefore the mantle of the divine falls upon Elisha. And he is inevitably the successor to Elijah as the teacher. The son, the use of the word son, is always in relation to the disciple. The disciples of the teachers were called sons of the teachers. The sons of the prophets, as they say. Not that each prophet had 50 sons, my goodness. Bit of a problem in all ways if each prophet had 50 sons of his own flesh and blood. They're his disciples. statement, that other statement, be fruitful and multiply, simply means that those who have seen the light grow in numbers. It's one of the, if you like to use commoner garden phraseology, proud boasts in the Pali canon, that the Buddha says again and again, that but in my dispensation, there are not dozens, not scores, not 100, 200, but 500 arahats, 500 bhikkhunis, nuns who have reached arhatship and so forth and so forth. You see, as contrasted with any other dispensation. But this is the form in which it is put, which perhaps was appropriate for those days. But for today, no, different thing. So now, this renunciation, why? Because Elisha could attend, completely attend to Elijah, stage by stage, out of the circle of Gilgal, the circle of misery and sorrow, into the house of the divine power. It's a mode of awareness, the transformed awareness, into the stage of fragrance. This fragrance is mentioned, for instance, these very things are mentioned in the Kaushitaki Upanishad too. And in somewhat greater detail, each type of mysticism has its own sort of formulae, you see. Some have much more expansion, some have less. And the stages of consciousness, for instance, in some of the Upanishads run into 13 or 14. In others there are only 3 or 4. And the Buddha gives 8 and so forth. And so from that stage of fragrance to the parting of the ways, and perhaps the parting of the ways signifies the complete letting go of this, the complete non-attachment here. This meaning, all that is worldliness in our consciousness. It is not the world of things that we have to give up. That is an easy way, you run away from it. You see, if you just do, what do they call it, a moonlight flit? You can do a moonlight flit, but afterwards what? You have to settle down somewhere else, which raises up the unfortunate necessity of performing a second moonlight flit. You see? Not that way, at all. But by being in the world and understanding, we shall of course be in struggle, conflict, difficulty all along the line. Because that is the nature of the world in which this moves. But if this inner awareness is the liberated awareness, and that is what is liberated, it's the mind, all the time the mind, not the body, not material things. That is why their answer is never in terms of the welfare state, or no poverty and no shortage of food, clothes or any such thing. It's never in those terms, because those things always perish sooner or later. Always there is conflict, there is struggle sooner or later. The deprived ones, the lustful ones, the greedy ones, they'll come and grab. With the welfare state has come increase in robbery. There you are. You just can't get away from it. Problem after problem. Increase the length of life, medical science and all the rest of it. Improve people's health, population problems. And with them, political problems. Where are the Israelis going to live? They must have a home for themselves. But the earth doesn't increase in volume. It stays put. You see? So their answer is never in material terms, always in terms of the transcendent. And this is something we must really meditate upon. That the answer has nothing to do with heart's desire or mind's formulation. Nothing to do with those. Now, the man of the world, the
the philanthropist, the politician who is serious natured, granted, sincere and all the rest of it, wanting to do good for his people and so forth. He would say, but this is hopelessly impractical. What's the use of this in our life? Let's get on with our conferences and treaties and whatnot and whatnot. That's what he will say. But tell me, is there anything more practical than the transformation of the person's awareness? Why do I produce a problem with my neighbor? Because I am grasping something. I am in conflict with him. It takes two to make the quarrel. If every one of us saw that, and every one of us, or at least the majority of the population, not only said, but was capable of ceasing to be the first party to the quarrel, there'll be no quarrels. It's the end of it. The complete end of it. And under those conditions where a person naturally is non-grasping, problems of food, of necessities can quite easily be solved. When Mrs. Dixon comes along and says, okay, have you got a spare loaf? Yes, if you have a spare loaf, it's given. When Sylvia goes to Mrs. Dixon and says, the shops are shut, have you got two eggs? Yes, the two eggs are given. Now we can do that on that scale. All right, let us do it on the universal scale, totally. How easy. Plenty of laughter and amusement and a little gossip over the gate. You see, pleasant gossip going on. Life is very pleasant, isn't it? So, in the long run, it is inevitably the only practical thing. Because whatever is done on the worldly plane, in worldly terms, is always conditioned, strings attached. $3,000,000,000 given by the World Bank to so-and-so, strings attached. This is hate. To put the other in bondage is hate, not love, not generosity. Give and forget very next moment, if possible, what's happened. You've given, you've forgotten, it's not there. There's no demand, there's nothing to get back. If I want to get back the limited and the particular, I completely block the infinite transcendent with infinite gifts. The one single taking back. Giving and asking and taking back is worse than stealing, as the children say, don't they? So there. What a profound truth. If we really see this, that the answer is in terms of the transcendent, and only the transcendent, which means the totality. If we really see that, we shall be free of all our scheming and planning and so forth. But because we don't really see it, we scheme and plan. Take no thought for the morrow. It is only the thoughtless, meaning carefree person, who can take no thought for the morrow. And it is only the selfless person who can take no thought for the morrow. See, the world condition is becoming more and more difficult. And it will keep on getting more and more difficult until it ends up in catastrophe. Have you ever seen the sort of pit, the form of history? Critical, 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 climax, catastrophe. Everlastingly it is like that. Everywhere, with every civilization, in all directions it is like that. This rising up to a critical situation of conflict, mind you. The crisis is the crisis of conflict every time, and then it bursts. Our life has been one long dis-ease so far. This is what history has shown us. And people have sought solutions in the wrong way. Even wonderful minds like Plato and Sir Thomas More and others were foolish enough to produce utopias, which is nonsense. It was the mind that didn't quite see. Great as Plato's mind was, and his was an extraordinary mind, one of the great minds in the world's history. Even they made the mistake, producing utopias, hoping for some sort of stability, some sort of scheme, some sort of method. And especially a person like Aristotle, placing faith relying upon the power of the logical mind, what they call being reasonable. But this power of the logical mind is the very thing that makes us hopelessly unreasonable where life in its wholeness is concerned. The power of the logical mind has to be exercised only in the particular and limited context. Making a motor car, the logical mind functions thus. Building a house, the logical mind functions thus. Cooking a meal, the logical mind functions thus. That is its proper place. But if you apply to life in its wholeness, this mysterious thing, life, if you apply to the psyche, this living, mysterious being, it's the wrong place. The Buddha says very distinctly, this Dhamma, this teaching, which is beautiful, wonderful, subtle, sweet, healing, etc., beyond all dialectic, not to be understood by logic. He says positively, not to be understood by logic. You see? This is the thing that will alter human life. And we are living creatures. We forget that. Look how when the names were mentioned, the livingness was lost, only the little conditioned images were present. Little bits and bobs. You take up a piece of a nose or an ear and say, oh, here's dear old Jim Smith. I wonder what lay behind that rather cruel-sounding little story told to children. The little one says to him, oh, Mama, what is this that looks like strawberry jam? Hush, hush, my dear, it's Papa run over by a tram. Very cruelly put, but how true. That is how I look at life. The mess. The bits and bobs. Life crushed. Look at the way in which Mama rebelled. Hush, hush, my dear, it's Papa run over by a train. She must have been terribly fond of Papa, mustn't she? Terribly fond. But love, no. Perhaps we see a little more deeply now the place of attentiveness and the implications of this thing,
attentiveness, of mindfulness. The Buddhist teaching of mindfulness, which is so fully given, has unfortunately, because of the verbalized form, just become a kind of a psychological technique, again a dead thing. It is not a living mindfulness. It is a mechanical thing. It's a machine. Something which will produce a technical result. Nirvana. Nirvana is no technical result. Now, just one last something to understand. And this is very, very deep. It sounds frightfully trite as I say it. The transcendent transcends the not transcendent. That is the limited and particular, the conditioned, the suffering, the infinite, you see, transcends the finite. Anybody may say, oh, good gracious me, what on earth have you said there? Now, consider carefully. To transcend means to be wholly other than, but not separate from. Now, if this can come as inward realization, it will just ease your whole vision. Make your whole vision easy. It's easy to see. You don't have to struggle to see the truth. To transcend means to be wholly other than without being separate from. Now, the infinite, the transcendent, transcends the not transcendent, the limited, the particular, the conditioned. You see? All right. It is the transcendent, qualitatively, is wholly other than the limited and the particular, but is not separate from, which means, therefore, that the power of the transcendent can always affect the not transcendent. Now, how does the power affect? Not because the transcendent wills to affect. This is where theistic religions have a faulty theology. You see, it doesn't will, it waits. The transcendent is in the timeless sphere. Time and process have no meaning, no significance for the transcendent. The conditioned has time and process, pain and conflict, the passing pleasures and so forth, you see. But when a vision awakens, and awareness becomes whole and complete and perfect, that I am the limit of the particular in this state, I really see it as such. In that seeing, the transcendent just flows through unhindered. And that is the Christ consciousness in operation, the meaning of the Christ consciousness, the meaning of redemption. In actual fact, it happens like that. If only the Christian world understood things like this in their depths. The Christian world, not just the great Christian mystics. It would make a tremendous difference to the material condition of the world, because after all, Christendom still holds the money bags which control, you see. It still holds the reins of power in manipulating world affairs. So, see if what you can make with that. Meditate on it. Just let the mind dwell on that. The transcendent transcends the not transcendent. To transcend means to be wholly other, to be wholly other than, but not separate from. Otherwise, there's no link. Otherwise,
God's there in his heaven thoroughly enjoying himself, all modcons and everything included. And here we are miserably suffering. You see? This is where the theistic religions in their theology have been faulty. To cut the link between the creator and the created. Eckhart completely went past all these foolishnesses. What Eckhart has put down and taught is second to nothing in the world, whether it comes from China or India or Timbuktu. So Christendom has it as much as anybody else. But it needs this letting the mind dwell quietly upon it. You just let the mind be quiet, and then that thing which is represented by the words, which means the images come close and are absorbed into the psyche. The conditioning powers, the power and so on of the images disappears in that. And the inner significance, the inner juice, the vitamins and the stuff of the images is absorbed in the soul, and vision opens up. Understanding grows. And when this happens, there is love. You know, if you've ever experienced it, whenever one is caught up in those states of complete quietness, the quiet mind in the real sense, and attentiveness, then when anything which normally would annoy and upset comes, nothing happens. Nothing happens to one's being. It just falls off. You know how the Upanishads put it? Like a ball of sand thrown at a rock, just falls away. Sometimes they say, like water falls away from the leaf on which it drops, you see? So too, all evil, all misery, all pain falls away from the person. But appreciate and understand the meaning of the transcendent answer. Nothing to grasp, nothing to gain, nothing to lose, therefore, also, and so forth. But just to be, and in that being is the awareness and the transcendence.